Freud gets on the list of great thinkers of the 19th and 20th century who influenced the 20th century and whose influence continues today for many reasons. One of my favorite kind of Freud stories was that there was a movie with Montgomery Clift called Freud. And it did no business at all. So they renamed it The Secret Passion. He Dared Go Beyond the Flesh. And it still did no business at all, but it was very good repurposing and trying to get a different audience. Freud was a scandal. Mostly he scandalized people who neither read him nor understood him because he dared talk about sex, sexuality, infantile sexuality, and used Greek myths to try to explain what he saw as some of the primary urges and developmental stages of human beings, the most famous of which, of course, is the Oedipal myth, which is every boy child wants to kill his father and marry his mother. That kind of scandalized people because children were supposed to be innocent, and those were all terrible, terrible things to do or even to think about. Freud was an interesting character, and when you look at his biography, you can see where you can imagine that you might, come on in, Glenn, you can imagine that you might be seeing where some of these things came from. His mother, Amalia Freud, was 20 years younger than his father. He had, you know, the usual kinds of things with brothers who were uncles and cousins and nephews who were older than he was, and he was uncles, you know, all the upside down and backwards stuff. And you wonder, you cannot help but wonder as you look at somebody's intellectual and philosophical development, the role that their own experience had in terms of how much older his father was. And his mother was not actually younger than Freud. That would have been difficult. He was born on May 6, 1856, in Czechoslovakia. His father was a religious Jew. Freud, like Marx, looked around at an early age and believed that religion did nothing but cause problems because he saw how Jews were persecuted. And so he had a couple of choices. You can imagine one of them would have been to say, here I am a Jew, persecute me or not, but this is who I am. Or he could have, as many did in Vienna, convert. Vienna was, when they moved to Vienna when Freud was relatively young, a very interesting place. It was torn between two great tensions, the tensions of modernity and intellectualism, philosophy, and of tremendous conservatism and fear of the new and the different. And these played out in Viennese politics and intellectual and artistic circles. Vienna had the most highly assimilated Jewish community in all of Europe. And by assimilated, I don't mean assimilated as in America where people don't care, but by assimilated I mean that a huge proportion of the Viennese Jewish community had converted to Christianity. About half of them to Catholicism and half of them to Protestantism. And one little-known fact is that even the early Zionists, before deciding that they wanted to invest in creating and buying and acquiring a homeland for Jewish people, the first thing that they looked at was mass conversion. Maybe anti-Semitism would end if we just gave up religion and converted. Vienna was the test case for this not being true. So that while it was highly assimilated and the Jewish community was highly assimilated, By the last quarter of the 19th century, there were political parties of anti-Semitism, and a famous mayor, Dr. Karl Lueger, whose statue is still in, of all places, Karl Luegerplatz in Vienna, instituted not simply anti-Semitic practices, but anti-Semitic laws. It is in this area where you have great philosophers and artists and intellectual adventures going on and speculation that Freud tries to kind of make his peace with who he is historically. He rejects religion, seeing religion really as the causes belli, as one of the reasons and the modes that people use to persecute each other. He looked at historic religion. We're going to see some of this later today with Jonathan Kirsch, who clearly accepts Freud's theories in Moses and monotheism, that monotheism was the gift of the Egyptians to the Hebrews, not the gift of the Hebrews to the world. And that's very core in Freud's Moses and monotheism. So he was fascinated by religion. He was fascinated by the development of monotheism. He was fascinated by Greek mythology and by Egyptian and other early Sumerian and pre-Judaic religions. I suspect, not accidentally, though probably not consciously, and we'll get to the conscious and unconscious in a moment, after Freud's father's death, he began collecting totems and fetishes from all different kinds of religions, from Eastern religion to Egyptian, and he had collections of these things in his office on, I think, 19 Bergstrasse in Vienna. And he had a fascinating collection of little fetishes, and I don't mean that practically, I mean the fetish objects. Whatever he did in his own private life is not important at this point. Other than one of the things that clearly fascinated him and that was central to what he saw as the development of human beings were the areas of consciousness and memory and identity. What Freud began to do as he studied medicine was to look for the I'm using some modern words, but what he was looking for, the biochemical basis of consciousness and of memory. He understood very early on in his explorations of neurology, neurophysiology, neuroanatomy, that memory was not objective. We were not perfect recording devices, and that we took in lots of information and we changed it. It got reprogrammed and reimagined through our own experiences. It appeared and reappeared in dreams and was relearned and changed by our memory, that what we chose to remember, what came to our consciousness, spoke, Freud believed, to who we were, to what the constellation of memories were. He talked about and really was foundational in putting forward the idea that, like an iceberg, beneath the surface of our own consciousness is a pre-consciousness and then a deeper unconscious that bubbles to the surface in ways that are not completely in our control, because we are trying from time to time not to think about elephants. Don't think about elephants. Don't think about those things that are disturbing. One of the real keys to the whole idea of therapy and of later on of analysis that Freud had was that information about ourselves, about our thoughts, about our history, didn't necessarily make us better or cure us, but it gave us the possibility of having some power over what we did. And in a sense, as Socrates had said, the unexamined life is not worth living. Freud, in a lot of ways, said the unexamined life is not within your control, because you will have all of these unconscious things motivating you by either attracting you to things that you find on a conscious level attractive, or repelling you for the same reason. Freud believed that attraction and revulsion were often driven by the same kinds of unconscious thoughts, memories, and impulses. So that when you found somebody, and of course this is not big news today, we all kind of figure out if you find somebody that is screaming about how patriotic they are, they may be taking bribes. If you find somebody screaming about how religious they are, they may have deep problems of faith. If you have the homophobe screaming on the corner, you might find him in the men's room later on. That the things that repel us and attract us are often on a very fine line that we repress and suppress. And bringing them out from underneath doesn't necessarily give us a cure, but it does give us some power and some choice. Freud looked at all kinds of ways of reaching into consciousness, into character, into the unconscious. He looked at hypnosis and studied hypnosis with two major hypnotherapists of the 19th century. The problem that he had with hypnosis, and it is one of the great distinctions between analysis and how hypnosis was practiced, was that hypnosis tended to be directive, which is you hypnotize the person and say, don't do that anymore. And Freud believed that being that directive did not necessarily help, that it, in a sense, suppressed the causes and treated only the symptoms. Freud thought that creating insight and the issues of, and he meant this a little differently from the way we understand it, the issues of transference and countertransference was to try to take individuals through the stages of their life and the development of their neuroses so that they would come through them, and in words that he never used, but I'll use it because we're familiar with it, to try to repattern the behavior, to go through the childhood experiences of how things developed and go through the relationship and the transference that Freud thought that most men had in terms of their harsh fathers, and that Freud encouraged the transference to the therapist, and that you would work through that transference, and eventually you would break with the therapist, having become an adult. The great philosopher Ludwig Wittgenstein pointed out that there's a problem with this, because there is, in a sense, no end of therapy. And Freud admitted that he was puzzled by, when asked, so when the person works through the transference, and they declare their independence and they say it's over, does that mean that all their stuff is resolved and they don't need therapy? And Freud did not have a good answer for that, and Freud knew that he didn't have a good answer for that. How do you know you're done? When are you sane? Wonderful question. So he looked at hypnosis. He, as people a few years later also tried drugs. He was fascinated by cocaine. Cocaine, incidentally, was society's treatment for morphine addiction. And as you may know, that heroin was society's response to cocaine addiction. So what you have is you have the downers being treated by the uppers, being treated by the downers, being treated by the uppers until you become one large speedball in the John Belushi Memorial Speedball. So he experimented with cocaine in order to, he thought that it would be useful in looking at how consciousness reacted to drugs. And he thought that it would help bring to the surface the fissures and the issues that almost all human beings seem to carry with them from past life experiences that get reimagined as obsessions, as compulsions, and can often become the driving force of by either their attraction or their revulsion. We're going to see in a moment, and we're going to see, I suspect, in our talk today from Jonathan Kirsch, that Freud became the austere father that he believed everyone had, that when his own disciples, and I use the religious term intentionally, started developing their own thoughts and their own ideas, they were branded as heretics and often read out of the meeting, and he didn't brook an awful lot of heterodoxy in terms of his own ideas. He was the great father, and anybody else who didn't like it was ausgeworfen. He was thrown away. And almost all of his major disciples at some times got split and exiled. One of the things to keep in mind, not just this morning, this part of the morning, but the later part of the morning, is how do we identify a religious system as opposed to a secular system or a religious system or a scientific system? The German word that Freud would have used for science, Wissenschaft, also means discipline or any kind of disciplined pursuit. It doesn't mean science in the sense that we normally mean science. And the German word in some ways is fudges a border between science and what I'm going to call for a moment religion. When Freud posits that human impulses can be seen in terms of these various drives, and he creates his own holy trinity of id, ego, and superego, it is, in a sense, an unverifiable holy trinity. It is useful, and it's probably not accidental that that later on Jean-Paul Sartre came up with his own but different holy trinity of être en soi, être pour soi, être pour autre, which is being of itself, for itself, and for others. There is some, to be Jungian, some archetypal threes that people seem to use to break down systems of understanding. But I think one of the important things to remember in the development of Freud's view of life and motivation and universe was that a lot of this was as, in a sense, mythic as the myths that he looked at. He looked for the truths in those Greek myths and stories. He looked more for the facts in terms of the Moses story, as I said, believing in Moses and monotheism, that monotheism was really a metaphor for God the Father. And as Jonathan Kirsch will talk about, that strong sky god, that unified god, that invincible sun, Sol Invictus, is a metaphor for the paternalistic control of the male father figure. Freud's experiments with therapy turn out to be quite interesting and, I have to say, problematic when you look at how he tried to treat patients. He saw in the turn of the century Vienna lots of cases of what was called at the time hysteria. Hysteria coming from the word for womb, uterus, as in hysterectomy. And by hysteria, he didn't mean hysterically funny. He meant what we would call a psychosomatic symptom, where someone takes whatever their fears, their issues, their traumas, and somaticizes it, turns it into some bodily or psychological dysfunction. And one of the interesting things about that I have found in life is that sickness and neuroses, and I don't use neuroses in a negative sense. If none of us was neurotic, none of us would have a personality. It is in our strange coping devices that we make ourselves and each other interesting. And so if you cure yourself of all neuroses, you end up with an automaton, with some kind of robot. Our quirks and our peccadilloes would make life really worth living. The question is not, do we have strange adjustments? Do those adjustments, are they maladjustments that get in the way of being with each other and of achieving decent goals and leading decent lives? Society, I think, teaches us how to be sick, and it teaches us how to be dysfunctional. In 19th century Vienna, there was a lot of hysterical disease. Freud wasn't making it up. People were, when is the last time you saw anybody swoon? I mean, it is true that there's positional hypotension. But I mean, the last time in the 19th century, somebody would come in and say, "Oh my God, did you hear? George Bush won by 3 million more votes this time than last time." and down they would go swooning. Almost nobody swoons today. You might have an organic issue of positional hypotension, you might have a blood sugar problem, but you just don't see that a lot. You're going to be looking, it's not how we react neurotically. We react neurotically by getting out our credit cards, we react neurotically by going to the refrigerator, we react neurotically in lots of different ways, but swooning doesn't seem one of them. Hysterical conversion doesn't seem to be one of them. Hysterical conversion is not, "Oh my God, I just found Christ." Hysterical conversion is, "I saw something so horrible that I'm going to go blind and I can't see." Hysterical conversion is, something happened that was so traumatic that I don't have any feeling in a particular limb. It is a radical transference of the trauma into the body. It happens. Therapists see hysterical conversion from time to time, but it is really rare today. And you have to wonder why, because it wasn't really rare in other times and in other societies. On the other hand, we have a whole bunch of diseases that they never had. And the societal aiming of how it is that we act out and identify ourselves as needing help is a very interesting subject, which Freud eventually started to deal with. Many of his cases involved hysteria. Many of his cases involved obsession. And not surprisingly, Freud believed that most hysterical, this is the Procrustean bed of theory, he tried to prove that most of those cases of hysteria and obsession came out of some kind of sexual trauma, some kind of abuse, neglect, obsession, that had sexual roots Now, given what was going on in the turn of that last century in Vienna, in some ways, not unlike America in the last quarter of the 20th century, you had a great deal of conflict between the conservatism of the churches, the libertine nature of the intellectual community, and that creates personal and social conflict. And both intellectuals and religious have some obsession with sex and sexuality. And so that you had tremendous tensions in the society that were reflected as tensions within individuals. And they are the tensions of order and of chaos. The things that state and church try to control, and these impulses that Freud believed were innate, and that if we did not examine them, they would control us more than the institutions would. I think that maybe the proof case for that are the molestation issues within Catholic clergy, where the price of repression and suppression of sexuality, of not dealing honestly with impulses. Now, dealing honestly with impulses is not the same as permission, but it is, if you can't get it out of your unconscious, if you can't get it out of your drives, you can't talk about it, you can't therapize it, and you don't have the same choices because you don't know what the issues are. There's a wonderful scene in Ordinary People where and I guess I mentioned this 2 weeks ago, where the young man, and Jed Hirsch is the psychiatrist, the young man is complaining because he's miserable. He said, "I thought therapy was supposed to make me feel better." And the psychiatrist said, "Not necessarily. Finding out who you are is not always pleasant, but it does give some choices." The other night, we went and saw the play The Goat, or Who is Sylvia? It is a play by Edward Albee, in my view, his best play since Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. And it's about a otherwise happily married man and father of an okay adjusted gay son who has fallen in love with a goat. And let me put it this way, the relationship that he has with a goat is a complete relationship. Did I say that nice? So it starts out as comedy and eventually morphs into tragedy. And it raises all of those issues, the nervous laughter in the audience, the hysterical laughter in the audience, about what will we permit ourselves to think and to feel? Will we give name and thought and consciousness to all of those roiling, bubbling, messy thoughts and fantasies that bubble up out of our unconsciousness? Are there limits? Are there limits to what you can think and feel and do? Or are there just some places past which you dare not go? And, you know, Albee in the beginning of his career would be writing about, you know, coded stuff about homosexuality, but that's not going to shock anybody anymore. I mean, it's very clear that the gay son is the healthiest, best adjusted person in the household. Well, I don't know about the goat. But where do you go in order to shock and provoke and ask people, are there limits to what you're willing to wrestle with emotionally? And if you have, I mean, how can we, you know, in olden days, a glimpse of stocking was looked on as something shocking. Now, heaven knows, anything goes. What do you do today in order to provoke people to ask if there are any limits whatsoever? And Albee goes there and then goes past it. As it goes from farce to Medea. Incidentally, if you're not getting what I'm recommending this, I am recommending this. This is one of the most interesting pieces of theater I've seen in the last 10, 15 years. Dennis, you had a comment.
Just going back to your comments about the sexual molestation issue in the Catholic Church. It seems like there seems to be two very important aspects of Freud's influence today in that situation. I think you alluded to it, I'm not sure, that if the priest is repressing sexual desires in order to function as a priest, which has to have an outlet somewhere.
Right.
Freud was the first one to introduce that concept. It's about that version of psychic energy.
Mm-hmm.
And the second thing is about this issue of what's a suppressed or quote-unquote recovered memory, because there's a lot of controversy about that, of course, because many of this experimental psychological community is suggesting that there ain't no such animal, and many of the non-experimentally based community think, yes, there is. And so we have these people walking around with these recovered memories, or were they really covered, you see?
Yes.
But that also is something that we inherited from Freud's influence.
If you don't name it, you really almost never have control over it. If you can't, if you're not allowed to think about it, if it is if you are being punished for impure thoughts, then you better not have those thoughts or admit that you have those thoughts. That's a recipe for disaster. The psychosexual abuse that often happens, and this is not anti-Catholicism at all. I spent most of my time in grad school defending Catholicism against Catholics who were really angry at it. But my Catholic friends, one of the major feminist theologians, Nancy Frankenberry, were very critical of the thought police in the institution. My friend Hans used to talk about how when he was in seminary, interesting word, isn't it, they used to pull down their pants every morning to see if their genitals were red, and if their genitals looked at all rosy, they were beaten because it was assumed that they were masturbating. Now, what a tremendous piece of therapy that is. Let's associate sex and violence. Just a sec. My sexual impulses are going to get me a beating. Oh, that sounds like a recipe for really healthy sexuality. It's kind of like, you know, circumcising the males at 8 years old, which can't be a good idea, you know?
8 years old.
No, 8 years old. 8 days, you can argue about whether there's memory or not. At 8 years old, there is taka memory, and that's when most of the Muslims do it, between eight and ten. And that can kind of ruin your day. Even though they give you a nice party and a parade down the street, you know, the guest of honor usually doesn't look happy to be there. So it was just, it was really circumcising the building, you know, that's right. It was the unmanning of it. So that you get in many religions an exhortation to repress what's normal and natural and to call it dirty, and then to pass that on, which has to have some kind of warping effect, or let's not call it warping, that's a judgment. It has to have some kind of effect on someone's development. The issue that Dennis raises about memory and recovered memory is a really interesting one, because it's an issue that goes back to the 19th century. It goes back 2,000 years before the Common Era. But it goes, and issues of reincarnation and what you may remember from a past life, and the experimental data on that are really interesting. I am not a believer. You know, when I hear reports that this person was regressed to a past life and spoke, you know, perfect Hebrew, I have some problems with that. Because it's one of those things like a friend from a friend from a friend. I'm going to have to see it and hear it. I'm also troubled by the fact that when you do past life regressions, almost everybody was a king, a queen, or a prince. Nobody kind of slogged through the fields or built the damn pyramids. They all had, you know, people with no lives today had grand lives, you know, three times ago. But Freud and the people who were experimenting with the hypnosis We're looking at trying to recover memories and traumas that people had repressed, covered up, and they were trying to access them. Now, what Freud understood and which calls into really deep question the recovered memories is that he wanted to recover memories, but he did not assume that those memories were genuine recording of facts as they happened, but that they were what was in there, and like dreams, they were inside, but they didn't necessarily represent history. So that in the Freudian system, if you recover that memory of past abuse, maybe you'll pass a lie detector. You almost certainly should therapize that memory because that's what's inside there. But it doesn't necessarily mean that it actually happened that way. Most therapists will look at somebody's history. You have to deal with what it is that they're carrying in here. And if you take out the photo album that says, well, on this trip, when you remember that your brother did this, here's the photo album, your brother wasn't there. Well, that may give that person an opportunity to make some adjustments to the memory. But the point is that the memory isn't objective, just as dreams are not objective. But they have to be, and here's a big jump, dreams like religion and scriptures, I think, need to be taken seriously, but not literally. Because what you dream may reveal something, but it doesn't necessarily reveal it straight ahead. Now, I love this part of Freud, because essentially Freud says that what later on Jiminy Cricket says, which is, a dream is a wish that the heart makes. And like the attraction and the repulsion, the dreams give us information about ourselves. Our likes, our dislikes, our repetitive dreams, our fearful dreams reveal something real, but not necessarily historic. And that in the analyzing of dreams, which Freud believed was a very important part of therapy, that truths about the individual could be brought to the surface and could be analyzed. Now, one of the problems is that since, I'm not going to be the first one to point this out, that almost every both fan and critic of Freud in the 20th century pointed out, Freud tends to see everything as sexually based.
Dream, and then you find out what important thing in the person's life addresses the dream, and vice versa. Not something sexual.
Freud created this Procrustean bed, bed being a significant choice of words here, in which to fit almost all of the human impulses. Here's another question of language. Freude in German means everybody. Joy, pleasure. Freud invented the pleasure principle and his idea that the human impulse was both towards pleasure, but more importantly towards the avoidance of pain, and that we flee both physically and somatically, and psychically from pain. So that some hysteria, some repression, some uncovered memories that need to be brought out through dream analysis and through free association and the association of Freudian slips, which we'll get to in a second, are revelatory of the unconscious. Now, let me give you a clear example about that. You're all not going to be watching me very carefully. I do a lot of singing when I'm alone because nobody can tolerate it when I'm with them. And someone pointed out that I might want to look when I'm in the middle of a song at where that particular song came from and whether it was revealing anything about my current mood. And in looking at that, since I don't have a good memory for dreams, they must be either really wonderful or awful since I'm either repressing them or they aren't interesting enough to make my consciousness, I have found that looking at the songs that I just start to sing often do reveal something about where my unconscious mind is, or my preconscious mind. You have to be a little careful about going down in there. One of the, I think, probably the brightest Unitarian minister I ever met, Clark Wells, this probably shouldn't be on tape, is a social lunatic. He is brilliant. He's absolutely brilliant. But there's no censor between his unconscious and his mouth, or between his unconscious and his pen. He has no manners. But you get this brutal and brilliant and sometimes beautiful expression because he doesn't have a censor that most of the rest of us have. He's all id and libido, ego, but no superego. When I read Anne Lamott, was wonderful, brilliant essayist and novelist, she has such a clear channel to all of the stuff that most of us spend so much energy trying to repress, that it's just that even when she's writing about what a fundamentalist she is, and she is a fundamentalist Christian, it is wonderful and brilliant, and I can't imagine spending more than a day with her because she is so in touch with all of this stuff. And I think most of us socially try to find some way of finding a happy medium between the chaotic and creative, which are related, and the social and the acceptable, which are always in tension. And if we don't have tensions, one of them is one. And if we are totally into the chaos and the creativity, we're not going to end well. If we are totally out of touch with the chaos and the creativity, we're not going to end well, because that repression, like political repression, will at some time bubble up and break us, because the stuff will not stay calm, will not stay unconscious. That the unconscious comes to the surface in unexamined ways that give us very little control. It is in the examination that we get some control. It's time, I think, for more comments and questions. Yeah, Jim.
Why is it that analytical psychology is kind of passed out of our thinking and psychology?
Yeah. Well, there are a couple of really good reasons for that. One is that no insurance will pay for it. And I'm very serious. No insurance will pay for it. The results are not verifiable, and it is a question of process, so that wealthy people who can afford to go 4 times a week, which is what normal psychoanalysis is, almost every...
Yeah.
That's a great line in Sleeper where Woody Allen wakes up, 200 years later, and says, "Oh my God, I go to a very strict Freudian analyst, and I owe them money for the last 200 years." That this relationship and this bond is hugely expensive and hugely time-consuming, and most people even get bored of listening to themselves after a while. But basically, I'm going to give you the Marxist part, which is it is economically unfeasible for all except the wealthiest to do analysis. Freud believed in free association, but there was a price. And the free association was that you have, he was very concerned about the influence that hypnotherapists had on their patients, and believed that the hypnotherapists, through their inductions and through their guiding, was creating memories, creating past lives, creating things that may not be there. So Freud, in developing psychoanalysis, put the couch here and put the analyst behind the patient so that the patient would not be seeing the analyst, you know, nod and pick up the pen every time he said mother, you know, because that was one of the dangers. He really wanted free association to be free association without the mm-hmms, to go ahead with that, how did you feel about that, and to bring it out and to let the the patient begin to create the analysis himself or herself by laying all that material out there. Hugely time consuming. Free association, now I will tell you that I was in analysis. I lived on a street where there were four psychoanalysts, and man, even I got bored with my stories. Although I got to tell you one funny one. I'll tell you one funny one. I was in the fifth grade, and I was telling him about the neighbor who had five cars. Nobody in 1955, 56 had five cars, and how he had a boat with three motors and three props. And so the analyst calls up my parents and says, you know, he's got a very vivid imagination, and you know, and it's really hard to tell whether he's delusional or not, or just fanciful and creative, because he was telling about the five cars and the boat with the three engines. They said, oh, the Hellers. Anyway, uh-huh. Okay, so that's my analysis. That's my analysis story. Well,
I have a brief comment and then a question. The comment is that the story about the singing reminded me of something I read recently, that supposedly Karl Rove walks around the White House whistling Onward Christian Soldiers.
Yes, we go onward.
My question is this, and that is, you were talking about Freud starting from a premise, or starting from a society that thought of children as innocent.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, thinking about Hobbes and people like that, you know, I'm not really sure that Western culture always thought of children as innocent. I mean, what was the idea of juvenile innocence actually a relatively recent thing?
I think that we're always in a tension between sentimentality and observation. You know, you have that wonderful scene in the movie where you see these kids and they're playing so nicely, and as he pulls back, you see that they're actually torturing an animal with scorpions. That society sees children as innocent and sees them as needing discipline, and I think that's one of the tensions and fissures in society. But they were very uncomfortable with the Oedipal model, with the idea that childhood sexuality just seemed to them to be inappropriate to talk about. And the idea, and you can imagine, I think you can imagine, that if you are in a time that doesn't talk about sexuality, sexual urges, has lots of nicknames for body parts, and all of a sudden a theory comes out and says your infant child has a sexual drive and a sexual response in finding the nipple and nursing, and the mother going, is it a baby or is that a man? And it's a tension that you can understand how, in a time when, in the words of that old hemorrhoid commercial, when problems could not be openly discussed, that was seen as a perverse view of children.
I think that particular issue, I think the fact that Freud, a very complex thinker and writing so many volumes, and people trying to understand his many writings and theories, you know, summarized way too much and oversimplified the
sure.
notion of sexuality. He's talking about kind of a life force.
Right.
Libido is a life force.
Yeah.
It's not sexuality. But he used the word sexuality because that's what he was trying to equate a very important part of the life force, which is our sexual feelings. But
he does move in stages from the genital and...
Right, but he uses the language of sexual development. Mm-hmm. And that's what I wanted to kind of respond a little bit to what you asked, Jim. Freud's influence, even though orthodox psychoanalytic therapy may be the other way, there are other forms of therapy that derive from Freudian psychoanalysis, which are still very popular and still very widely used. The other thing is that there are various aspects of psychology itself, as a science, especially child psychology and developmental psychology, which owe their origins to, in part to Darwin, but mostly to Freud, because he, in fact, more than any other individual, established the discipline of developmental psychology, studying, for example, the influence of parents on children, and the important role of the parents' thoughts, beliefs, and behaviors on children develop. But those ideas come from originally from Freud, even though the concepts that he used may be passé, the discipline of studying those issues originate primarily with him. So there is an influence there.
There's a very interesting principle of Freud, which I think speaks to the issues of sexuality as well as the issues of law. And that is Freud's observation, and I think that this is a really good one, is that we only prohibit the things that we want. So that when you look at the taboos, and that's really how he came to the incest. He looked at every society, and he said most societies have an incest taboo. Why would you have to have an incest taboo unless people... we're going to commit incest? Why would you have legislation against murder unless people murdered, against stealing unless people stole, against human sacrifice unless there were human sacrifice? So he said, look at what a society prohibits and really puts beyond the pale in terms of taboo, and you will learn something. If you see it in every society, you will learn something about who human beings are and what human beings are. Tom and then Glad.
What was Freud's view of puberty?
Chaos. That it was the time and the same old story. Yeah. In the crucial time of psychosexual development, if there is a rejection, if there is a failure, that puberty is a period of tremendous. And this is just clearly true, a tremendous psychic vulnerability.
Well,
where
it's just a biological fact that now you are equipped to express your sexuality. So prior to that,
well,
yes, he's talking about some incipient tendency.
No.
You got 3 months, you're beginning to think about it?
No, I think that you are... trying not to say it this way. I think you're drawing a harder line than there is. I remember, so sorry this is being recorded, taking my son to the doctor when he was about 6 weeks old, and as normally happens, the doctor isn't there, and you know the nurse said, undress him, and I put him on the table, and he began to find himself and amuse himself with his maleness. And the doctor came in, and I said, you know, we're waiting so long that I'm very concerned that he has learned to masturbate in that time. He looks at me going, I know that you're a liberal. Why are you looking at me like that? And I said, because I wasn't 13, Donathan, that I learned how to do that, which probably wasn't true, but I don't remember being 6 weeks old. But I think that what we would consider in the definitions that you're setting up, the pre-sexuality, the self-gratification that is non-orgasmic, is still self-gratification and was seen as just part of the discovery and the development of oneself and one's sexuality. You know, what happens when, as in my friend the priest, I'm a former priest, I've married him twice since then, what happens in his psychosexual development when at age 4 and 5? If you touch yourself, you're bad, you're evil, you're going to hell. There again is this association of even pre-sexuality with badness and with violence and with judgment and with rejection.
But this is not occurring naturally in the child. Carl's just pleasurably aware of
sure, self. Of course, and that's what, and that's Freud's whole point. It's not a, it's the neuroses aren't occurring naturally in the child. The neuroses are being imposed by the tension that society has between how it feels about sexuality and how it feels about masturbation, how it feels about childhood experimentation, if you have two little boys or a little boy and a little girl or two little girls, and what society does to act and react or overreact to those situations, that they're the things that I think we would consider to be normal and natural developmentally, and then there's society saying, but you're bad.
But you're also telling me that Freud subscribed to this notion that society and that this was sexual. That's Freud's choice of word, and I would have thought that he would have delayed the use of that word until sexuality was, let's say, apparent.
No, you did. I think that
why did he use the word sexual at a time when it doesn't appear to fit?
Well, I think that he understood pleasure and genital pleasure, and he was willing to put that into areas of sexuality when and not have it necessarily directed at another.
But doesn't this make it confrontational?
What made it confrontational was Fox News, was the Fox News of the time, was the society that picked out the good parts, the sexual parts, the kind of how dare he say this about our children parts, and image it and re-image it as if it were the whole story, as opposed to seeing what Freud was doing, which was a continuum on sexual development, as opposed to the fast lines of this is sex, this isn't sex. He was talking about pleasure, gratification, avoidance of pain, and seeing it as a continuum, as opposed to putting in hard definitions of whether it's genital, whether it's orgasm, whether it's non-orgasmic, whether it's clitoral or vaginal or anal or whatever the various stages of sexual development that he had. And what happened was that the press grabbed a hold of the parts that were interesting and exciting. If you go to Vienna today and you go to the University of Vienna, in the central courtyard, are statues, busts of the great professors, and it takes a double impasse to find Freud. You get the last one.
We talk a lot about sexuality. We talk a lot about balance or tension.
Mm-hmm.
When did the term mother, father, God come into play? We always have heard Freud, father, God, okay, and all the religions, father
mm-hmm.
and then son.
Mm-hmm.
But yet there are some religions like the Church of Religious Science.
Mm-hmm.
They have a tendency to incorporate God as father, mother, God.
Yeah, and Mithraism did, and I will argue later today with Jonathan Kirsch that Catholicism does too with Mary. And the biggest controversy today, not the biggest controversy, the theological controversy today is that Mary is a co-redemptrix with Jesus. That in most religions you will find the female and the mother God sometimes reimagined as wisdom and sometimes as Holy Spirit. But it's not accidental that Sophia in Greek is a woman, and that's wisdom. Chochmah in Hebrew is wisdom, and that's female. And Shekinah, which is compassion, is also female. You have, and this will be central today, I think that you have in almost every monotheistic system, both dualism and the female divinity historically suppressed. You do have some religions that really focused on the Mother God, and the Mother God is making her return.